we'll filter in and we'll have them join. So I'm sure you've all been getting my emails, but this morning we have John Doonan here from Aberystwyth. he's going to give us a little introduction and brief discussion about his work with some high throughput phenotyping that he's been doing over there across the pond. And hopefully we'll have a little bit of a conversation about what kind of traits are being measured there and if there's a specific method that we want to approach capturing these traits in the trait ontology. So with that, I'll just sit quietly and let John take over.
Welcome, John, and Lol, if you can hear me, can you record, please?
Yes, yeah, so the recording is running.
Right, perfect. Thank you.
Okay. Hi, Pankaj.
Hi.
Okay, so I'm going to switch over to full screen. Hopefully, won't lose you. Okay, so this, I'm just going to give you a brief run through of some of the technologies that we're using at Aberystwyth. The first slide, I must admit, I haven't written this specially for you guys, so it's going to be the same as the department got a few weeks ago, more or less. So one of the things we're interested in at Aber is dissecting the genetic and environmental effects on various types of crops. We've got a public good plant breeding program still running at the university in a variety of orphan crops, and I'll come back to those at the end. So we set up a few platforms that help to undertake phenotyping, hopefully in a high throughput way, but at least in a different way than before. And just before I'll give you a bit of introduction to the department, it's called Aber's Institute of Biological and Environmental and Rural Sciences, and it occupies a little spot on the west coast of the UK, looking out over the Irish Sea. It's one of the biggest agricultural departments in the country with about 1,500 students and £31 million annual income. About half of that's from the students, half from research. The strategic programs in the department are crop genetics and breeding, primarily of crops that are suited to the western seaboard of Europe, so that the light, cool, damp, wet conditions. So grasses, oats, clovers, a little bit of wheat and barley testing, particularly with regards to mild, wet climates. On the other side of the department, there is the animal science and rumen microbiology, and that intersects with bioenergy and biorefining, and the rumen microbiology feeds into the bioenergy and biorefining in order to isolate high-value chemicals from the plant. Okay, so the National Phenomic Center, just to provide you all with where we sit, so over here, if you can see my mouse, we've got the department. In the middle, we've got the Phenomic Center, and that's funded by the BBSSC to provide access to various groups to this to automated high throughput phenotyping. We've also had funding from the European Union in fond memory thereof, and et cetera, et cetera. And hopefully we'll get that renewed next year, and that provides access for other countries within Europe to use the platform. We're connected to a number of breeding companies, including a note breeding company, Synova, and a variety of grass seed producers. What I thought was this talk would provide you with a sort of an overview. Part one is an introduction to the platforms, the capabilities and throughput, and then a few random, not quite random, but almost random projects to illustrate some of the approaches we're taking, and then some of the challenges that remain in order to utilize this fully. So the type of platforms we have installed are essentially shoot, root, and grain related. So the shoot platforms, we have essentially three of those. Two of them are based on conveyor belts. So the photon systems instruments, one is a roller system that takes, can you see my mouse?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So it takes little trays of plants, and here we have a tray with Arabidopsis plants, past a watering station. There's load cells in under here that lift the plants up and weigh them. The plants come around here on a predefined sequence, either once a day or as often as every 15 minutes. Takes top and side view images, and fluorophyll fluorescence, and then of course you can bolt on whatever sensors you like. And so, in addition to the ones that come with the machine, its capacity is about 2,000 pots, so it's relatively high throughput. The Lemnitech system deals with medium to large size plants, from wheat, young wheat plants, up to Miscanthus, which is about 6 feet high. So it's quite flexible. Its throughput isn't quite as large as 880 pots approximately. Whoops. But it's got more modalities, including root imaging, laser scanning, thermal, NIR, and a couple of others. It's not as fast. Once a day imaging is about all it can do with when you've loaded it to capacity. And then there's a plant eye from a company called PhenoSpex. They can automate it, and we're testing this for potential use outdoors. It's a moving head laser scanner. The laser scanner is hanging on a bar in this case, and it moves across a series of pots to give you a point cloud of to give you some 3D information. Currently, it's manual, and the throughput is rather low. Roots. The root platforms include our riser boxes, and these are transparent-sided pots, essentially, either 50 centimeters or a meter deep, and you get a view from all four sides. We normally run these in batches of up to 500 columns, and we've been doing mapping of root traits using these. Mini rhizotrons, these are for Arabidopsis, and what you're looking at here is from the top view, these fit into 96 well plates. Those of you who do molecular biology will be well familiar with these, and they're flat-sided strips of open bottom tubes, essentially, that you can do very high throughput chemical screens. This has been developed by Brian Ford at Lancaster, and is really ideal for Arabidopsis phenotyping. One of the oldest phenotyping platforms is the Nutrien Flow. This was built during the 1980s and has been running ever since, and the breeders use this for looking at nutrient use efficiency in their breeding populations and selections. There's eight independent tanks that are monitored and adjusted independently in a control room that's off to the side. The plants have each got their own little 1 liter chamber underneath this tank that's covered in silver foil to keep the light out. The size of the tanks is so that the nutrient is at about the same concentration as you would expect to find in soil water. That summarizes the phenotyping on these is done manually, with the exception that the nutrients are taken back into an analysis room, and you can monitor the uptake and concentration of nutrients in the solution pretty much in real time. Okay, so the seed platforms vary from tissue and cellular level, with an in high throughput in situ platform with facilitated wax embedding and sectioning, through to the process, slide processing, and we've managed to run reasonably high throughput screens of where genes are expressed, for instance, in Arabidopsis meristems and in wheat grains. We've also got facilities for looking at GFP expression using a cell transformation system. Marvin is essentially a rather expensive flatbed scanner that allows you to take out morphometric measurements on seed and grain. We've used this for mapping grain traits in wheat populations and during looking at it during domestication. A more recent development is CT scanning, where this is an established biomedical technique that image is based on water content, and this is ideally suited for seeds ripening fruits, such as this is oilseed red, and you can extract a lot of information both on the organ and on the individual tissue layer. So we're using this to look at the thickness of the seed coat in brassicas and how that relates to germination. Okay, so that about covers all the indoor platforms and analysis aspects of the phenotyping. We don't look after the metabolomics and the other aspects of destructive phenotyping. So, but we integrate with those in the computational side. So just to briefly run you through that, we break that into data acquisition, which involves both the environmental data, the images from the various platforms. LemonTech and Photosystems here have their own bespoke software for collecting and handling the images. For the LemonTech, we take those into our central repository and then process them ourselves. With Photosystem, we utilize their software and skip across to the data integration. Their software works quite well, and we haven't been motivated to try and improve on it, except for something I'll say at the end. On the side, then, we do all the traditional physiological and manual measurements, particularly destructive measurements at the end or harvest measurements for those where we take them through their life cycle.
John, can you say what the env data at the top? What is that precisely?
Oh, environmental data.
Yeah, what kind of data is this? Is this coming from the instruments or?
Yeah, so this is coming from the glasshouse. It's also coming from our own sensors. So we've got LiCAR sensors for light. One of the things we realized that depending on which glasshouse it is, the temperature gradients within the glasshouse are a little bit more than might be desirable. So we have scattered mini weather stations throughout those particular glass houses, so we can correct for those gradients, relative humidity, that kind of thing. The other thing is water use. So on the platforms where we have gravimetric weighing, the amount of water delivered to the plants is recorded every day, and so you can work out an approximate water use over their lifetime or over any period that you could. So there's a reasonable diversity of data coming in from different sensors here that has to be eventually integrated over on the far side. So the physiological and manual measurements, they vary a lot from experiment to experiment and really are dependent on what the user is hoping to get out of the system. So, for example, we've got reasonably sophisticated chlorophyll fluorescence kit that you can look at that in some considerable detail, but it's time consuming to do properly. So not everybody chooses to do it. So feature extraction, that's one of the things we concentrate on, because the commercial software is still very much under development. And because some of the companies have taken shortcuts, it's sometimes difficult to know what they're doing. So they, along with computer vision people in Nottingham and also in the computer science department here, we've started developing alternative technologies for that. Then over on the other side, we're looking at different ways of integrating the data, and that varies from the application of IsoTab format for annotating the experimental metadata, to a package called Zagami that sells itself on being able to handle large numbers of images and the associated data, and allows you to jump between the data and the images that give rise to the data points. And then in terms of integrating with the genomic data, our bioinformatics department has developed a number of tools, and then we're collaborating with people at Rothamsted, Chris Rollins on Ondex, with a view to looking at the genes underlying the QTLs that have been identified. So as I say, this is evolving and is in a constant state of flux as we develop new tools and replace old ones. Okay, so how am I doing for time? It's progressing on quite fast. So a few example projects. So one of these was an EPPN funded project to do with strains altered water responses. We first of all had to develop some of the tools to look at these. So this just illustrates some of the feature extraction type routines that we've developed. Some of the commercial software has come with these, but they're not necessarily all that flexible. So this illustrates trait extraction that combines height information and color information. So as the plants develop, this is wheat going through its life cycle, and for any one particular plant, you get an enormous amount of information in terms of its color, its height. As it ripens, it goes down, but as it ripens, it also senesces. So you can derive various parameters from this that can describe the progress of the plant mathematically, and that's one of the using those traits to map the genes controlling those dynamic changes is quite interesting. Some of these are throwing up what we think are previously unrecognized growth-related QTLs. So the other types of feature extraction is looking at flowering time. This is something that can be done manually, but needs constant surveillance, whereas leaving a camera to look at it, you can spot, for instance, panicle formation. This is in oats, and using a texture detector, you can get a mathematical score of when the panicle emerges. And feed that back in against the genetics. The growth stages can either be scored from the images, but usually we go down to the greenhouse and score those manually still. That seems to be a much more effective way to do it. So looking at programs that looking for routines that can do that, I think is automatically would be quite an interesting but challenging type of procedure. One of the traits that's of a lot of interest in terms of serial breeding is tiller estimation, and particularly the time at which tillers appear. And this is using a Frangley filter that's the biomedics use for looking at blood vessels in kidneys and other surgical samples. It can be easily adapted to recognize and discriminate between tillers or stems and leaves. And this is a pilot experiment where we've established a reasonably good correlation between what we get out of the computer vision approach and what we get from scoring. So this has now been applied to breeding populations under different stress conditions to see if we can automate dynamic tiller counting. So then combining this with the watering, this just illustrates on the image side, you see two watering stations on the Lemnitech system. As I mentioned, the plants come around this at least once a day. The imaging is generally restricted once a day, but we've got the plants can be circulated independently within the glass house. So they can be fed water relatively frequently if necessary. This just illustrates the three on the left-hand side of the slide. It illustrates the three watering treatments. And here we have a once-a-day watering to a target weight. And it's the real big benefit of these automated systems is that they take all the guesswork out of watering. Here we have a target weight set at an intermediate drought value. And whoops, go back. And the bottom one is essentially a drought to lethal or semi-lethal levels. Hopefully the next slide will work. It's a video of the three treatments growing. I don't know whether that goes across.
Yeah, we see it.
You see it, and it's moved. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the well-watered on the left-hand side, intermediate watering on the middle, and the severe treatment. So this is the miscanthus. Sorry, we're getting a bit of feedback there, so I might have to do my... I can't get at my microphone.
John, your audio is failing.
Okay, I shall... I was getting a bit of audio feedback, so... I was moving away from the microphone, so I'll come closer again. Hopefully it won't.
Thanks.
Won't too much. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah, okay. So this is a, after the data has been extracted and looked at through time, we can split the, it's a diversity collection of miscanthus, and we can split them into two different groups. One that shows quite a pronounced response to intermediate water levels, and one that more or less ignores it. So the miscanthus guys have been using this approach then to further screen their diversity panels and also their breeding populations. Okay, I shall skip over this fairly quickly, as it's I guess the main point in the breeding programs is that many plants overreact to mild stress conditions, and the breeders want to identify ones that don't really slow down just because they've had a temporary drought. So then if we skip over to Arabidopsis, we've used the small plant phenotyping system for a variety of projects, from mutant characterization to looking at diversity panels. And this just illustrates evaluating gene complementation of a mutant by wild type genes and then different phosphomimic alleles of the same thing. And it's a very nice quantitative view of how the different mutants complement. The punters were very happy with that. But the real strength of the system is for looking at large populations and exploiting the sophisticated genetics that's available these days for gene discovery. So one of the things we're aiming to do is to try to get predictive phenotyping in these complex mapping populations. One of the interesting things that's very apparent is that you get the appearance of what would be considered classical strong mutations coming out of these populations, provided during your population establishment you don't select against them. So this is something that looks phenotypically identical to curly leaf. This is a small dwarf, and there's a huge bunch of these that come out from these. So we've run a population that's derived from 19 intercross magic parents. We've looked at the first 500 rills with their imputed genomes. And one of the things that comes from this study is that just a top-down view of the plant doesn't really capture, even though it's a rosette plant, it doesn't really capture the full 3D information. So, and that becomes more intense as you go into looking at flowering. Another experiment using this population is looking at density effects on the plant. And that's where we've looked at one plant versus four plants. And what we really want to do is to look at the traits, not only during the rosette stage, but also during branch formation. The system is not ideally suited to looking at the 3D structure from the side, in that you've got overlapping structures by the time all these guys flower. However, the sort of information that you do get out is pretty good. So this is just looking at the parents, get height information, branch information, and fruit number. The fruit number has to be done manually so far, but we're looking at ways of doing that, and I'll show you some of those ideas. I got a little bit ahead of myself. So 2D information from these systems is really good. You get a lot of accurate information that matches up very much with what you measure manually. But when you grow them densely in 3D, the situation is much more confused. So counting Arabidopsis fruit would be very useful, but the 2D system is not sufficient. So we're trying to develop 3D models that then we can utilize to give us that sort of information. So this is one of the 3D model systems that we're using. It's based on 2D photography, but taking a lot of images from different directions all around the plant. And that allows you by the something that's related to stereo imaging. so-called structure from motion. It allows you to compute the likely 3D location of the plant structures. So these give you relatively dense point clouds. They're a little bit better than lasers because you get, in addition to the positional information, you also get color information, which can be quite important deciding what's happening. So at the moment, we're trying to combine this with growing plants in dense trays and then identify them and then card them. So this is a bit of a challenge. Where we're at the moment is starting to extract features from these and feature extraction. This is work in collaboration with IPK in Germany, and we're gradually getting the segmentation and organ identity techniques better, but we're still not in the position where we can reliably get the information out on a particular leaf at a particular time. Likewise with branch information, branches are an important aspect of quite a lot of crop physiology, including competition between plants and how the plants orientate their light harvesting organs within the canopy, and getting a measure of the branch angle and stem orientation would be advantageous. So on single plants where you don't have occlusion, this is a real plant, but it's been somewhat trimmed. The technique works relatively well. We want to eventually start to get information from models like this. So this is a clover plant. I'll show you first of all with its leaves on, and there's probably information on the stem angle and such things in there, but it would be very hard to extract this automatically. If we, this I think is the same clover plant with its clothes off, and then having got rid of the leaves, it's much easier to see where the stems are and potentially extract these stem angles automatically.
So, John, you removed the leaves programmatically, right?
No. I'm afraid in this case we cheated. We removed them using a small pair of scissors.
Okay, I get it.
So they ideally...
we should be looking for something which is a leaf-like structure, and we remove them programmatically from the images.
Yeah, I mean, ideally that would be very nice, but you still have the problem of occlusion after you've removed them. However, we could collect much more detailed information and make a more detailed model that would potentially allow that. Uh-huh. But before we do that, we want to be sure that we can extract the information underlying with relative ease. So this is some of the approaches that we're approaching these problems in from different directions. Uh-huh. So this. Illustrates trying to get the stem angle after we've physically removed the leaves. So we can isolate individual stems, and then when we've segmented them out and isolated them, then we can get an angle for that particular stem. So it's slowly coming together on that side. But then the other thing is applying it in the system where the quality... So one thing I should add is that these images are taken with a domestic camera. So it's a high-quality digital information acquisition device. What the companies on the automated theme parking systems tend to sell you is industrial cameras that will last for a long time, but they're actually not as high quality as the what you can buy in the consumer market these days. so they'll never wear out, but the quality of the image is not necessarily as good. So we're now applying the same sort of techniques to simple systems like wheat seedlings to look at not only the angles, but after these guys come up and form extra leaves to try and count the leaves and recognize tillering. So this is early stage type approach at looking at a germination and then multiple point clouds, multiple plane fitting, and gradually build up the feature extraction. So that's more or less where we're at with 3D models of the above ground information. If I go to some of the other challenges, roots are still a big challenge, really. This illustrates the transparent columns I mentioned, going through image acquisition, the type of information that you get from the feature extraction, and then QTL mapping off that. So in this particular case, it's just root quantity and depth in a few different strains of a ryegrass. I think it's a ryegrass mapping family. Yes, it must be because of QTL mapping, yeah. In essence, the pipeline is effective and the throughput is okay. One of the problems is that roots like to grow in the dark, so we can't keep them on the conveyor belts. And image quality could have been better. We've now re-engineered this to take them off the conveyor belt and to have imaging stations in the greenhouses where they're grown. And that has had the interesting effect of actually increasing throughput quite substantially. The other challenge is partly managing expectations, and that's the effect of scale and throughput on the type of question you can ask. And effectively, the more detailed the information you want, in terms of on the cellular or tissue level, generally the lower your throughput. Whereas the higher your throughput and the larger the scale, the less detailed the information you get. So on the field scale using UAVs, we've got a little spin-out company that provides services to farmers and breeders based on the reflective light from breeding plots. And these, on the right-hand side of the screen, what you're looking at here are test plots just outside the buildings with rows and rows of grass growing.
For everyone, I think the one, the picture of the plot on the very extreme right is taken either using a UAV, I guess, or a drone.
Yeah, so it's taken using a UAV flying at about, I think, 600 feet.
Yeah.
So the company is a spin-out out of the geography department that specializes in remote sensing and earth observation. And they've got a lovely suite of tools for extracting various reflective indices from this.
So what's the resolution in that field setting, John?
In that case, I think the pixel size on at 600 feet on that flyby was something like 10 centimeters.
Okay, yeah. So that means it's different from country to country. In the US, I think the FAA regulations is about 3 feet. But there are the machines can collect the resolutions to close to around what you're saying about between 6 to 10 centimeters. how much data can be made public is 3 feet, I guess, either for satellite or UAVs.
Yeah, so the more recently we've the group in geography has got a new grant from the local government to retool its drones, and we're thinking of buying some of the little orthocopters that will take a reasonably heavy load, and then we can fly very close into the crop or you just restrict the higher flights to the UAVs. So the I think this was a fixed wing UAV that took this. So yeah. Quite a large area.
So was that a hyperspectral camera mapped on it, or just a simple one?
This was a I can't remember the name of it. I think it's a Tetracam.
Okay.
Does that ring a bell? It's not a hyperspectral, but it's a multispectral. So this just illustrates the RGB channel on the on the flyby.
Okay. No, that's fine. Thanks.
So then the next one in, the little bluey green turquoise square with a funny flecks of color in it. This illustrates PhenoSpex laser scan of one of these little tiny plots in here. So we can go from one scale to almost too much information, but we can relate one to the other.
So that's LiDAR, right?
No, it's laser.
Laser.
It's a near-infrared laser that apparently works in the sun. You can't actually see it when you're scanning. Mm-hmm. But it seems to be insensitive to sunlight, so it's quite robust in terms of using it either indoors or outdoors.
Yep. Thanks.
So, and then the roots, we've been relating the root columns to the guys when they dig up the plants. One of the species of grass, or one of the grass breeding projects, is to get deep rooting grasses in order to help with both nutrient acquisition and flood control. And these guys can send down roots to 2-3 meters. So we've been relating what to find in the field, what we see in the columns, and with a reasonably good correlation. Mm-hmm. So in summary, what we're finding is that the images contain a huge amount of information. We take the low hanging fruit at the moment. What we're trying to do is to develop unsupervised methods. So a lot of the company software needs quite a bit of supervision. For instance, the LenderTech system is, you really ideally need to grow the plants on blue plastic granules if you want to image from above, because it's almost impossible to separate the plant information from the soil using their software. However, if you... with the software we developed, it's much more flexible and can discriminate between plant and soil under most conditions. We're now in the process of trying to extend that to make it more flexible to different imaging conditions. What we find is when we change platform, we have to re-engineer the software for this. And certainly when we go outside, then it becomes even more difficult. From what I understand, that applies to machine and deep learning approaches as well. They have to be retrained depending on your imaging conditions. Going to data sharing and reuse. So far, the raw data is rarely shared. Phenotypic data between use, between labs is also rare. And one of the things we're particularly interested here because of the nature of the crops we're using is to try and use phenotypic data across species, particularly where traits and QTL are concerned between, for instance, oats and wheat, and could be extended to other crops if that works. So then acknowledgements, probably not everybody's on here, but these are the guys that did most of the work. Roger Boyle, hiding in at the back there. He's a computer vision specialist, and a variety of folks who have carried out some of the projects that I've told you about. BBSSC and the European Union provided most of the funding, and with that, there's a view out the window. Well, not quite, but I think that gives you a quick whistle-top tour. Not quite half an hour. Sorry about that. But
no, it's fine.
No, yeah, it's wonderful. Yeah.
It sort of illustrates some of the technology and hopefully also the limitations of where we are in terms of extracting the information from those platforms.
Yeah.
Okay.
Great. So we should probably talk a bit about the data sharing aspect of it.
Yep.
Maybe you could go back to your slide, the one with the kind of like the pipeline with it as a tabs kind of and things near the beginning.
I should have broken out. This one. Okay, so the easiest stuff to share, and what we're aiming to have our systems compliant with ISOTAB. At the moment, they're intermittently compliant because we haven't embedded it within everything on the left-hand side of the system, but we're working through that in collaboration with the guys in Poland to implement that. What is more difficult is in terms of image sharing, so the raw data. Nobody really wants that because the size of it and the inconvenience.
Yeah. I mean, I assume within Plantium, I don't know, actually. I'm kind of thinking from a more narrow Plantium perspective, but maybe I'm sure. I don't know what the plans are for the images, actually. So someone else should speak to that. But yeah, I was just wondering just about capturing just the broad, you know, some of the kind of like the just very broad kind of like, you know, maybe the kind of stuff that goes into QTL mine. It looks like that part of the pipeline, you know, you have your kind of QTLs, and then you have kind of, you know, you maybe have, you know, kind of stress trait or something like that, and you've got the association there. Is that the kind of thing that we should be thinking also about pulling into Plantium?
Yes. So that would be relatively straightforward to share, in that the data by that stage is very compact.
Right. So, I mean, I think what we want is we need to think about how we want to bring the data into Plantium is at the population level or at the individual plant level, because there are both kinds of data that is available in this set. So all your raw data and metadata is associated to the individual plant, but the overall analysis of the QTL mine would come up at the population level. Right, and so there. This is one thing. The second thing is for the computational biologists like Yue Zhang and Eugene Zhang and Sinisa are on the call. is they would love to, probably they would love to have access to the raw images so that they can build some better tools. For example, if we have your root development data from different soil types, they would like to see how they can differentiate or better algorithms to remove the background soil from the actual root information. And actually, if I look at it in that way, a research project would be is that under, if you grow the same plant, for example, under different root conditions and you have the images over a period of time to see how the soil texture actually, obviously one thing is to remove this background soil, but the other one is how the soil texture changes the morphology of the root, and can you build prediction models around it, right? And the third one obviously is the repository or coming back all together. I don't know where we should be doing that. That is a big challenge, where we should be storing and how, as you mentioned, that from one experiment to another experiment, it's hardly reused, right?
Yeah, so the the root experiment is potentially a very interesting one, because the soil that we use changes color depending on the water content.
Yes. Yeah.
It's there's a very good correlation between water content and the color of the soil, but it does lead to a slight problem in getting an accurate measure of the roots in the different soil colors.
That is true. But so, for example, if although this one is based on the images through a transparent surface, right? Yeah. Otherwise, the other option is to do a CT scan every day, so you know you can basically for that many plants, it will be a challenge.
You cut down your numbers as soon as you start CT scanning quite dramatically.
Yes, there is no high throughput available for CT scans right now, but essentially, if we can just track the original thread of the root tissue and see where in that background it is going, then there will be one way of looking at it, and I'm pretty sure the people who are already working on it, they are thinking in that direction or already working on that. So there is a lot of raw data that can be used for some interesting machine learning and tool development aspects, not only for roots, but I believe you're also looking at the leaf angles and how the leaves are, number of leaves and how the leaves are rolling in the field. You would say based on the density, how those things change parameters. There are lots of them, and then you also want to predict how, for example, if the reproductive flowers and things come up on the top of the flower is, if you're taking a picture from a UAV using what percentage of your plants actually have the inflorescence and things. So these are more predictive tools to say that, oh, 50% of my crops or 20% of my crop in that field or in that plot is at this particular stage in terms of growth stage landmarks.
There's a few things. the root data, we'd be very happy to share. I'd have to check with the owner, but the owners are internal to the department. Mm-hmm. We know that we don't get all the information out. Right. that's for sure. The wheat data, we've got an experiment with a wheat magic population that's, they're just about to publish the first part of the image analysis, and that data then, as far as I'm concerned, as soon as that's been sent out, that's available for sharing.
Mm-hmm.
It's been really analyzed at a very simple level in terms of height estimated by mass and color. So there's no other information that's been taken out of it digitally. The other one that presents us with a bit of a challenge that I didn't have time to talk about today is mixed species. If anybody's interested in the challenge of quantifying one species within another, I should explain, step back a little bit and explain what it is and why it's interesting from our point of view. A lot of the department works on animal forages, and forages are generally swards of either one or two or maybe more species. The ones of interest are clover grass swards. So it's a, one would imagine that's a very simple challenge to take those swards apart. And we've had some little projects running to explore possible ways of doing that. I can share some sample images of the swards. The breeders have got the ground truth of the two botanical separations, which are immensely tedious and messy kind of analyses to do, but it essentially means paying students to pick grass from clover and weigh them. So there's a bunch of type of projects like that, and the reason why they're interesting in a wider sense, I think, is that discriminating between weed and crop is like an advanced version of this. And that still remains a challenge, particularly when you're discriminating between two different types of Laminaceae. Whereas the clover in the grass has got attractions in that at least the first stage is simple. You've got a big visual difference, at least between the two species. The other challenge, which we've been discussing, is in terms of CT scanning and extracting some traits from this are very easy, like the seeds from typical crops like oilseed rape or from wheat, fall out on a simple segmentation basis. But if you want to look at branch structure within, say, wheat spikes, that's a challenge. We've got lots of data sets that we'd be happy to share on going through the domestication series for wheat.
So when you're willing to share data, at what level is the data that you usually have in a shareable format? The raw images are obviously images, and then once they go through some sort of analysis, they're in like I'm guessing some sort of like pixel number or pixel color ratio. When they're finally ready to be used for like a QTL map, they have to be put into some other like more realistic trait.
So in terms of the after feature extraction, they essentially end up as a number in a spreadsheet or a CSV file. So that's one level at which we can share, but to some extent, that's not where we see the main challenges. The main challenges are over on this side, where we're still extracting features from the images or from the 3D models.
Right. So the unit that you have on the in the spreadsheet is what unit? Like a pixel, or is it like a ratio, or?
Oh, the unit is generally, by the time it reaches a CSV file for QTL mapping, it's if possible, it's either a metric unit or a ratio.
Okay. Okay.
Or potentially a value for color, which would. So it's those kind of parameters.
So I believe by the time you are reaching the far right hand side, your data repository, you would, Austin, you would have the trait and its measurement that you have extracted from the images. So at that at that level, you are exactly this at the same place where the current QTL data, current practices in classical QTL data is. It's the on the middle and the left hand side where the method of collection of data is a little different. You're not scoring at the trait level at that point. You're just scoring some features. Obviously, those are traits. So first is to extract the actual features that you want to address out of the background, and then start scoring the traits associated with those features. So for example, if there is an imaging of the root, you will look for the more number of lateral roots, the length of the lateral roots and the primary root, and the thickness of the roots, and those kinds of traits you will start extracting once you have removed the background. So there's a little bit of machine learning, and then after that is scoring.
Right. So, but if there is there a desire to share the raw data, which would require some new or some different standards or traits or terms in our ontology on our side to allow some standardization of that image? Like, obviously, once it's to the point where we're talking about plant height, we have that trait that's pretty standard. But if we're talking about like number of pixels per pixel image, or you know, number of green pixels in a certain ratio to the red pixels or something, that's something that we don't have a trait to capture, because it may or may not be something that's plant specific even. You see what I'm saying there?
I think yes. So what you're talking about, how that measurement was done, so it goes under the method, and I believe I think it's a different aspect. So for example, if you count the number of roots, you are looking at pixels, but by the time you're looking at the number of roots, you've already done that based on combining the pixels that are of similar type. Right? So that's what you're basically constructing, that thread of pixels that are of same type.
If you look at the slide up at the moment, I think this illustrates it in a way. The image is first converted into some sort of mathematical representation of what the program ascribes to root material. So this is one image, but then this is a graphical representation of, I think, five different strains. And I think this one, though I can't really read it even myself, so I apologize for that, but I think this is root density along a root column.
Yes.
And then that gets converted into something that you can plug into a typical QTL mapping program. In this case, I assume it's, there's various different proxies which equate to root width, root depth, the total root volume, which is essentially the area under those graphs. So in that way, it's very much like, by the time it gets over to QTL mapping, the person doing the QTL mapping wouldn't really know whether their traits have been collected by a machine or a person.
Sure.
Right. So, but on the other hand, I agree with you, John, but for example, if in a classical study, somebody would looking at a root width, they will take a vernier caliper and then actually physically measure it. That's one way of saying. But in this case, Austin, what is happening, it would be a mathematical formula. It is a mathematical construction to get you to that trait. And
right.
That is where I think the abstraction is coming in. And that would vary from software to software.
So yeah, I understand that, but I'm curious if so the data that's being shared is on the level of the abstracted data. So the root width, the depth,
yep.
Those things we can capture quite easily with the trait ontology and the plant ontology. Mm-hmm. But if someone wants to share the rawer data, the pre-mathematical formula, because running the, you could change the mathematical formula and get different outputs for your root width, root depth, et cetera. But that's not possible once the raw data has been abstracted away. So I guess, is there any push to get standardization on the raw data side so that information doesn't just become abstracted into root, width, depth, et cetera, things that are already being measured manually or through other methods? Or is it maybe a case where we just need to quantify the, or somehow standardize the mathematical formulas that cause the abstraction so that the raw data can be reverse engineered, perhaps?
So what we've started to do is to save a copy of the software that's actually used in a particular experiment, and that follows, so the version number follows the data, and it needs to, in essence, stay with it as metadata. The software then is lodged somewhere where it's accessible, and when the paper is published, ideally the software version should be accessible alongside it or by link or some other mechanism.
So can you reverse?
It's possible to fiddle with, I shouldn't say fiddle, but it's possible to change so many aspects of the software that potentially easier just to lodge a version of it and try and describe it precisely.
So if someone has access to the final data, the root width number, et cetera, can they, and the software version, can they reverse engineer the raw data?
Oh, that's...
In what sense?
Like the pixel numbers and the ratios and the things that are actually being measured, those disappear when you publish the data that is annotated as a root number or color, et cetera. But if you have access to that data and the software, can you essentially flip the equation around and generate the raw data so that you don't have to share the raw data? You can share the abstracted data, which means something to biologists, but then everyone else, if they need to or want to, can reverse engineer the raw data and run a different analysis or perhaps a more up-to-date software on it.
I suspect probably not. I don't know, but I suspect some of the processes are really only run in one direction.
Yeah, that's what I assumed.
Yeah.
I can't quite see how... Yeah. And I think the answer would be no.
Okay.
So that also comes to Chris and other folks has come to a question, and I think where do you want to maintain, because if you're, for example, doing an ontology annotation and you're trying to bring this data in a GAF format, where do you store this context information that this unit was derived based on the software XYZ version 1.0 or 2.0, and that needs to go somewhere.
So that would be in the, you know, the evidence. There would be an evidence type. And then there would be, with GAF, you have to kind of cram it into kind of something like the width column or the reference column.
Extended information column.
No, it doesn't belong there because it's not describing the biological properties. So it would have to go in something like the reference So you can have a kind of like a general reference that describes that particular kind of protocol, or
so you create some kind of an abstract for the cite that abstract, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, Mari, do you envision bringing this, creating a crop ontology identifier for this particular method? Because I don't know, this is not crop specific; it could be generic, right?
Yeah, and I don't think this is really a method or not, because for me, you are not looking at the plant directly, you are looking at an image. So maybe, I mean, what you try to measure and all the calculation that you do is more image characteristic than just a plant characteristic. And from the image, you will derive the plant trait. So...
For example, if somebody is looking at a rice root root width evaluated using this method, and the same way you might be able to do it for corn, but also for the same method, you envision that it will not sit in your crop ontology?
I mean, I know that for the sweet potato and maybe wheat, banana. Yeah, they added some image method, like you mentioned.
So yeah, but we need to have this whole algorithm and pointing to the software version which was used. So it's much more detailed than just creating a name for that method.
I do agree.
Yeah. Okay. Well. I mean, we got to kind of wrap it up here. We're a little over the hour now, but I just wanted to make sure we thank John for coming to the meeting and extending his half an hour presentation.
But if people can stay for a few minutes, John, what is I know it's coming to an hour, but I would like to see how do you envision Plantium working with you on this thing? Are you gone, John?
I think there's the very simple, I shouldn't say very simple, but the straightforward thing of providing a mechanism for us defining ontologies for the methods that we've developed to date. The software problem is interesting, and the computer guys have been discussing it. I can bring this discussion to them. They'd envisage the software would be lodged in something like GitHub and then made available in that.
It depends on whether it becomes an open source or not.
Well, true. But most of the things we're doing are open source or...
Yeah.
That's in the intention.
We may be able to create a bibliographical record for that particular software, and all the other pieces of that would go in. So every time the same method was used or same version, you would use the same bibliographic record from us, and we can provide that option, or you can just create some kind of an app, some kind of an ID for that to get in.
And then the idea has been floating around in Europe about the need to publish raw data sets and to get publication DOIs on them, so that will. I think that IPK in Germany is gearing up to actually handle large image sets. So I don't know whether they've handled anybody else's but their own.
Right.
So that would be potentially something else that could feed into any database or repository ideas that might be floating around. There's also what I didn't really go into is the derived phenotypes in terms of dynamic GTLs, which we're just starting to think about. So there's a couple of different ways of doing these. One is if you go back to I'll just go back to the slide to illustrate. So on this slide here, the factoring in the time vector on it allows you to extract derived parameters that sort of give you, in essence, QTLs that relate to how the things like growth rate and change in whatever parameter you happen to be measuring. But then in addition to that, there's if you take a slice through time and you do a QTL with the data, a QTL analysis with the data that you extract at a given time, you get a slightly different spectrum of genetic regions popping up sometimes. So there's interesting things that potentially could be done with that, with the sort of dynamic traits that one acquires from this sort of thing.
Yeah, I can imagine.
That we haven't really thought about, because we've only really started doing those analyses and realized that these two approaches are giving slightly different answers, and both of them are right, or at least we believe both of them are right. So there's other things that are popping up that we need to think about in terms of how we organize them and what we call them.
Cool, very cool.
I think we kind of need to wrap up here. So thanks again, John. This has been wonderful.
That's no problem. Yes, thank you. Works quite well.
We should be in touch with you. And what I'm planning is to do is to bring in more talks like these and see how Plantium. So we would ask you and request you to come over and join the call so that we can see what are the high throughput challenges are, and come forward with the next rounds or something. Like, what can we do collaboratively?
Okay. Yeah. That sounds a good idea.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay.
Have a nice evening, everybody.
Cheers, then. No, have a nice day. Yep.
Yeah.
Bye.